Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, folks. Great to be back with another session of Ashoka U Online. Had a really fantastic time with Fadi Handour last week, and I am equally thrilled and just really excited for our entire group that we have Dr. Angel Cabrera with us tonight. As I think all of you know who've been following on Twitter, Angel Cabrera is not only the president of George Mason University, but he is the president of George Mason University as of today. This is Dr. Cabrera's first full day in office in this position. Previously, Dr. Cabrera was the president of Thunderbird School of Global Management, and he has had a lengthy and extensive career in higher education. He is a global leader of tomorrow from the World Economic Forum, previously a young global leader, and notably for the purposes of the course tonight, also the author with Gregory Unruh of Being Global, How to Think, Act, and Lead in a Transformed World. So, Dr. Cabrera, I hope it's okay if I call you Angel tonight.
Absolutely, please.
Sure. Okay, well, thank you very much for being with us for this event. Now, since I'm a professor here at George Mason University, and it is your first day on the job, the folks on the call here, or the folks in the course, think that I'm probably going to just try to go easy with my first question, but I'm actually going to ask you a difficult question for my opener. And that is the Spanish team that we saw yesterday the best football team ever?
Without a doubt. I'm only slightly biased, of course. But I'll tell you what, and I know we don't want to spend too much time on soccer, but there were a couple of very profound leadership stories in that team. That was a team where no one player was the star of the team, and together they all were the stars, and that doesn't happen that often in soccer. So there's a lot to be learned from that team.
Yeah, four goals, four different players. Obviously, I'm not someone who follows this as closely as you do, but even a superficial observer like I am, had a thought today that this was a special victory and a special team from that standpoint. So it's great when teamwork dominates over pure self-interest, to bordering on selfishness, that we see often in professional sports. It doesn't seem that unusual, though. We had that phenomenon certainly with the Patriots during their run, and it seems like a lot of the really dominant teams have this characteristic of sharing the burden.
Yeah, someone ought to do some research on that.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, well, anyway, so now to transition to another way of looking at leadership, but as you suggest, maybe not all that different, being global. Now, I am very interested in talking about your views on higher education, your reflections as you begin your responsibility at George Mason, and also your thoughts on something like what's going on with this course, where we have students who are enrolled, as you know, from over 50 countries, 500 students, regular students in the course, and another 300 plus who've joined us as auditors. So that's certainly material I want to get to, but I want to start with your book, because it really seems that whether we talk about sports, education, or any other domain of human activity, that this theme of being global is one that comes up over and over again. So could we start by just sort of, you're taking a little bit of time to give an overview of what being global means to you and what you were trying to articulate with your co-author in this book?
Sure, I'd be delighted to. And fully realizing that with the diversity of folks who are following this course, I am totally preaching to the choir, as they say in this part of the world. But nevertheless, we were motivated to write this book because not everybody gets it. And I'm assuming the vast majority of people following this course do, but not everybody does. In fact, you still have these coin phrases that are repeated over and over again, like think global, act local, like all action takes place locally, and that all you have to do is sort of focus on the constraints and the issues in each particular environment. And at a time, those commentaries made sense at a time where I think maybe we were erring on the side of maybe cultural imperialism and imposing uniform solutions around the world. But the fact of the matter is, if you think of today's most interesting opportunities, if you're, let's say, a business entrepreneur, or all the most complicated issues and problems, if you see yourself as a social entrepreneur, they are of a global nature. And global issues and global opportunities can only be addressed from a global standpoint. I don't know how you can address issues of, let's say, global change or infectious diseases or water or you name it. You can go down the list of the things that you're interested in or worried about without thinking of them in a global context, because the resources that are necessary to deal with those issues, the people, the expertise, the capital, the technology are going to be available in very different contexts, cultural contexts across the world. So what we try to do in our research and in the book is to pay attention to those people who get it and those people who master it, those people who are very good at it. And by being good, I mean those people who succeed at bringing together capital, resources, and most importantly, people who find themselves in different parts of the world and bringing them together effectively to craft a new solution. And we've looked to at people from many, many different contexts, some social entrepreneurs, some business entrepreneurs, people, for example, Shai Agassi, the founder of Better Place. In this case, it's a business venture that tries to address issues of transportation, sustainable transportation, and the like, and individuals in many different sectors who've succeeded at, as I said, bringing resources from different parts of the world. And out of that analysis, what it became clear is that people who get it and people who are effective at it shared three sets of skills in common. And by the way, as a disclaimer, I have to say that after the book was published, and I got my hands on Phil's book, The Common Prosperity, I was amazed that, in fact, we had come up with very similar words to define these. I think, Phil, you use also the words connect, create, contribute, and I think you add collaborate. I guess we must have been a little slower than you at getting that the last one. But I'll explain why.
Yeah. Well, that's funny.
Yeah, those three components and what they mean. The first thing that the individuals we looked at have in common is the ability to connect with individuals who do not share their cultural background. In more technical words, that ability has now come to be known as a global mindset, which has been the subject of extensive research at my previous institution at Thunderbird, by a professor by the name of Mansour Javidan. People with a global mindset are able to look at their reality from different angles. They're able to connect with folks who come from a different, who come with a very different set of assumptions. And normally those people have three sets of skills, which is what we call psychological capital and intellectual capital and social capital. In more plain terms, psychological capital means your cognitive ability of suspending judgment, of being open to a different perspective of on one reality. The intellectual capital has to do with things you know about other places around the world, in people who are successful, on the global arena, they know a lot. They travel, they read, they interact, and they're accumulating facts about what's going on in other parts of the world. But the last one, social capital, is the ability to develop trusting relationships with people from other settings. And that's a lot easier said than done. It is human nature that we normally gravitate towards people who are like us, not different from us, but like us. You go to a new conference, and very immediately you're going to find yourself somehow finding people who are like you, who look like you, who speak your language, who may have gone to a similar school. You're going to somehow, you have a radar that somehow brings you to people who share as many things in common with you, at least in appearance. It's a lot harder to develop those relationships, those trusting relationships with people who come from very different cultural settings, who may profess different religions, who may speak different languages, who may look very different from you. So those three sets of psychological capital, intellectual capital, and social capital make up what we know as a global mindset. And that's sort of the building stone of global leaders, to have that ability to connect with others. Now, that in itself is not enough, right, to become a global leader, to become a successful at really crafting new solutions. Because you could have a tremendous sort of intellectual interest in getting to know the world and not really use it to enact change. Global leaders add to that ability of connecting, the ability to create new things across differences. And that's what we call global entrepreneurship. And what's fascinating is that these global entrepreneurs, because of their global mindset, they understand what's different between contexts, but they also understand what is similar across contexts. And they know how to leverage both. For example, sometimes a successful entrepreneur understands that a product that works in the U.S., let's say the iPhone works in the U.S., and very immediately you realize, hey, this product could sell in Western Europe and China and other settings because there are things that those markets have in common. So we all the time look at successful entrepreneurs who use their understanding of similarities to expand markets for their products. But also, other entrepreneurs, or sometimes even the very same entrepreneurs, they leverage their understanding of differences to create value. And that's the beauty about entrepreneurship, right? And that's I guess what Phil you write about, and Schumpeter will always reminding us of, that entrepreneurs thrive on differences, right? Entrepreneurs are able to sort of bridge differences. When markets are perfectly efficient, there's very room for entrepreneurship. When there's disruption, that's what entrepreneurs make things happen. And that, you know, that happens, for example, when you decide to take one technology that is in one place and not in another and apply it in a different way, or when you decide to put your supply chain in different parts of the world, when you're sort of connecting the dots, bringing things that are available in one place to another scenario. So that ability of creating value, of using that understanding of differences to bring people together and create a new solution, a new product that didn't exist, or create a product that existed before in a more effective way, that's what we call the global entrepreneurship. The last piece of the puzzle, though, and that was the most difficult to articulate and to get our hands around, is what we call global citizenship. We realized that almost invariably, all the successful global entrepreneurs that we studied in depth, all of them had something unique about their view of what their solution did in the world. And it doesn't, and this didn't apply just to social entrepreneurs, who, in a way, they come to their ventures with a much more social motivation in mind. This applied to also business entrepreneurs, who always saw themselves as really as good guys, as people who were making a difference beyond their product, beyond their success of their venture. They were making a positive difference. And we spent time trying to understand and put words to the notion of global citizenship. And finally, we found our answers in the most unexpected place. And it was by, in fact, spending time with the Dalai Lama in one of his visits to the United States. He came to Thunderbird to see us, and he delivered a tremendous lecture where he basically defined global citizenship. And we, I guess, realized that global citizenship is a very Buddhist concept, because he says, basically, in Buddhism, you understand two things. One is that we're all interconnected, that in fact we're all members of a, if you will, of an organism that is bigger than us, that what happens to me affects you and vice versa, that we're all somehow interconnected. And the second thing is, if you believe the previous statement that we're all interconnected, then it makes perfect rational sense that you would be compassionate and careful about what you do that might affect me, because if you don't, you're hurting yourself too. So like, if your pinky hurts, your entire being hurts, right? You cannot have a healthy body if a part hurts. Well, actually, those fundamental ideas describe what a global citizen is. Someone who understands that what happens in one town, in one region, in one country, impacts the well-being, the prosperity of what happens in other towns, in other cities, in other regions, in other countries. And as a consequence, they approach business, they approach their solutions with that understanding in mind. So you don't, in a way, hurt workers in one place to benefit shareholders in another place or customers in another place, but you're trying to figure out how your solutions are contributing to some greater good. And in fact, that attitude helps global entrepreneurs be successful. Not only it helps all of us, because people with that attitude obviously drive businesses that have better impact for all of us, but in a way, they also help themselves, because that attitude allows people to develop the trust that is absolutely necessary for the longevity of any business venture. So it is that combination of a global mindset, being able to connect with others from different backgrounds, global entrepreneurship and global citizenship, that really is that mix that has contributed to making global leaders successful. So that's in a nutshell the essence of the book, Phil.
Well, that's a fantastic summary, and you know, as you were describing it, even more than when I read through the book, when I was sort of, you know, internal to the narrative, it struck me that this is a sort of subversive story on a couple of dimensions. I mean, the first is that if you asked anybody, who hadn't taken a look at this book, what a global leader is, I think a lot of folks would think about, the lineup of heads of state at the G20 or something like that, and maybe about a bunch of folks convened at Davos. I mean, you do talk about UN global leaders at the World Economic Forum, and you were one yourself, but it sounds like what you're talking about in terms of global leaders doesn't have a lot to do with formal positions of power. Am I reading too much into that, or is that what you intend?
No, you're absolutely right. In fact, some of the cases that we use in the book are people who don't come from those circles. One of them is a woman who actually, after the years, she's become someone I considered a friend and I admire deeply, an Afghani woman by the name of Rangina Hamidi. Rangina had escaped Afghanistan with her family, eventually settling in the U.S. after going through Pakistan when the Soviets invaded. And then as soon as the Taliban fell, she, in a question of a couple of months, she was back. And she went to Kandahar, her original hometown, but also the heart of the Taliban. And she was motivated initially as a sort of a social angle in trying to figure out ways to empower and to help her fellow women who had been totally and brutally oppressed in Kandahar. She came to a program we were running at Thunderbird, and And she realized that in her case, to be able to have the impact on the scale that she wanted to have, she was better off switching from a traditional sort of NGO mode to a business profit-making structure. And she created, you know, a handcraft business where she would, her understanding of the culture in Kandahar allowed her to create a very successful venture. For example, she did not create workshops that could call attention from the Taliban. She created clubs and homes where women would create this beautiful embroidery. But she also understood international markets. And she had designs that came from designers in the West, and she had relationships with distributors and fashion centers and fashion distributors in the West. So she was that global leader. And this is not a woman who you will read about on Fortune magazine, and yet she created a dynamic that allowed to create economic opportunity for about 500 women in Kandahar by just connecting the dots between really a totally isolated city in Afghanistan with wealthy markets around the world. So that is global leadership according to our definition.
Well, and to follow up on that thread just a little bit more, I mean, in terms of these different types of capital that constitute global mindset, or that relates to global mindset, you know, you don't really feature financial capital and startup funding and so forth and so on. You know, and this all of the financial dimensions of success and entrepreneurship. Is this for real? I mean, from the world that you see, are folks who have the sort of global capabilities that you're describing and creativity and imagination, do they have the possibility to create change at the scale that you're describing, even if they don't have a couple million dollars in the bank or access to that in some sort of immediate way?
Yes and no. So first of all, there is some correlation between your ability to develop these skills and income. So obviously, to develop intellectual capital, you have to study and travel. I mean, there is no alternative, right? Either mm-hmm. you read The Economist every week, and you watch foreign movies, and you read foreign literature, and you embed yourself, or most likely you travel the world, and you visit places, and you go to museums, and you really embed yourself and learn about how the world works. All those things correlate with resources. So there's obviously but many of the folks that we've met are not who we consider very effective. Most of them, in fact, they did not grow up in wealthy contexts. They did not grow up in sort of expat or diplomatic families traveling the world. These are people who found their own paths. Now, on the other hand, many of the folks that we studied, they use those abilities, those global leadership abilities, to secure the financial resources that they needed for their venture. So it was precisely their global leadership ability that allowed them to find the resources. Shai Agassi is a good case in point. Now, Shai was not he was first a business entrepreneur in IT from Israel with great connections in the U.S. He then sold to SAP, moved up the ranks of this multinational software company. But eventually, when he created Better Place, which is a very peculiar solution to really create high long range electric cars, he raised money. He used his ability to connect his social capital to raise the resources that he needed, and he used it to open the markets that he needed. So yes, it takes some resources to be able to develop these skills, but these skills are absolutely instrumental in mobilizing the capital that you need.
Well, you know, I mean, I think that I certainly believe your message here. I wanted to, you know, hear your articulation of that. And so on one hand, this notion that global leadership, as you're describing, is an accessible, characteristic quality. It's something that we can each nurture in ourselves. It doesn't have to do with formal positions of power. You know, that I think is a kind of a disruptive or even maybe subversive idea. I mean, the other one is, you know, you've got a book about global here that's not about insensitivity, it's not about exploitation, it's not about impersonal economy. Are we supposed to now love everything about globalization because there is this possibility of being a global leader? You know, how would you situate your book in that debate?
Well, I mean, this is our view. I mean, and by the way, what we did is really we totally skipped the debate over globalization. We acknowledged it, but skipped it because honestly, we didn't think it was very useful to get into this dynamic of would we better off without globalization. Globalization has had, and when it works, it has the ability to pull millions of people out of extreme poverty. What has happened in China, what's happening right now in India and other parts of the world, an economic transformation of that magnitude is something that human history has never, ever seen before. The level of prosperity, of economic comfort that millions of people are reaching would not be possible with it. Now, does that mean that globalization is perfect? Absolutely not. It is leaving people out. It is creating new sets of problems that we don't know yet how to deal with. But our approach is, rather than discussing how good or how bad it is and what is the balance, is we know that globalization can work. How can we develop more people who can make it work? How can we help more people have the skills that can leverage globalization? We use a story in the closing chapter I think it was Benjamin Franklin leaving from the Constitutional Convention of the United States when he was approached by someone, a lady who was waiting outside, and at the time it was not clear whether the fathers of the founding fathers, what they were going to come up with. And they said, Dr. Franklin, do we have a republic or a monarchy? And the answer was, you have a republic if you can keep it. That's in a way the way we feel about globalization. We have inherited the tools to make a huge impact. And the tools of globalization, they were not free. They were developed through a lot of effort, through a lot of bloodshed, through many mistakes made. And in a way, we have a globalized world with huge opportunity if we can keep it.
That's great. You know, I was just tweeting, something related to what you were just saying. And Jacqueline Novogratz of Acumen Fund tweeted, Nick Kristof's column today about how 6 of the 10 fastest growing economies in the world are in Africa. And I think it's a great sort of exclamation point on the comment you just made. I would be delighted to just continue on and discuss this sort of rich content that's in this book and the set of insights that you have. But I want to get to some calls or questions via Twitter. And before doing that, I have to ask you about your day to day. So, I mean, you know, why would you, given everything that you've described, but also all the transformations that we know are taking place in higher education, all the disruptions that appear to be either in process or around the corner, why would you or anybody else want to be president of a major university like George Mason University?
It's fun. It's it's one of the most exciting. First of all, as you are, Phil, I'm a vocational educator. I've always loved education. I've always thought of myself as an educator. My grandfather was a teacher in a poor little town in Extremadura in Spain, in poor Spain. And I've always thought that education is just one of the most noble and personally rewarding things anybody can do. I've been involved in education for a long time. I was the dean of one of the top business schools in Europe, I guess, in the world, in the early 2000s, and then at Thunderbird, and I've always been fascinated by how institutions of higher education are dealing with the changes around us. It is amazing how much inside universities we understand the environment and how it is changing, how we document the trends in technology and industries and so forth, and yet at the same time we're so bad and so slow at dealing with those changes, and that is really what fascinates me. I see some of the pressures on higher education in the United States, but actually around the world, even though they manifest themselves in different ways, as really at a tipping point. I think we have now the mix of pressures, both from just a pure financial and budgetary side, but also from the enabling technologies that have emerged. We are at a tipping point. I feel like there are new models are already emerging. Fascinating new models of education are emerging. Some of the existing entities and institutions may not make it. That's sort of in a total Schumpeterian way. Many institutions will not make it, and others will thrive. And I feel one of the things that really attracted me to George Mason, if you allow me to put in a plug here, was that the George Mason is a place that is innovative and entrepreneurial and that sees itself as such. That it's a very young university, only 40 years old, just celebrated this year, and that has always seen itself as almost the new kid in the block, the challenger of the status quo rather than the defender of the status quo. So that's the reason why I came to Mason. I feel we have all the tools. This fascinating community of faculty and students, and we are in such an exciting economic area right outside the capital of the U.S. and also incredibly interesting economic hub as well. So I think we have the tools in front of us, and now it's a question of figuring out how to take advantage of them.
Well, you know, since you sent out a message this morning to the George Mason community, and you made reference to an event that I alluded to actually in the call last week with Fadi Handour, and since you made reference to it in your letter, I feel as though I can bring it up in this call, and that was this this recent development at the University of Virginia, where for our global audience, a university president was removed by the board that governs the University of Virginia, and then as a consequence of controversy over this decision, then reversed itself and, as I understand now, has reappointed the president. Now, when we look at this discussion that you just described, this opportunity here and at other universities in the country, what kind of a lesson do we draw from that sequence of events that at least in the public media was framed as some sort of for or against online education or for or against change in the university? Is that the way that we should look at that? Or, you know, thinking back to your leadership discussion earlier, is it really more of a leadership question that we should be taking away?
It is a fascinating case study, and with many different dimensions in my view. Now the media has picked up on more of a sort of the dramatic side of the story, the personalities of the individuals involved, the transparency or not of the decisions made, and all that. And there is a lot of interesting lessons on that side on how boards make decisions or should make decisions and how those decisions should be communicated and the like. But to me, the side of that story that I'm most intrigued by is that in a way that has been the most clear manifestation of the pressures that universities are under. And it's sort of the most visible symptom of that. I mean, you have, in a way, the outside view of a board, which in the United States, for those who are not familiar with the American universities, how they're governed, boards are mostly made out of independent citizens who volunteer their time. In the case of our universities in Virginia, they're appointed by the governor. So you have the view of this, this is mostly business leaders coming from the outside looking in and realizing the dangers, the competitive dangers, the fact that the universities have to change. And you're contrasting that with a view of a university that in a way also is trying to hold on to a mode of understanding education that we're not sure is going to be viable in the long run. And the way that tension manifested itself in Virginia just made it very visible. But I'll tell you, every university across the country and outside of the United States is dealing with that type of tension. Again, you know, back to the notion of entrepreneurship, it is when there are disruptions, when there are tectonic shifts in any industry, that entrepreneurs jump in and thrive, or at least some of them, by finding new solutions, and the incumbents suffer the consequences and struggle to deal with them. And that's, I think, that's at the core of what we've seen at UVA. But as I said, it's been more visible there than everywhere else, but everybody's suffering similar tensions.
Well, I mean, you know, that actually certainly resonates for me in terms of this notion that entrepreneurship, which is what this course is about and what a significant amount of your recent book is about, is inevitably a process that invites retribution or at minimum some sort of a pushback from whoever's position is being challenged. I just was motivated when you were talking to pull up one of my favorite quotes from Joseph Schumpeter, and he's talking about the work of entrepreneurs, and he says, to undertake such new things is difficult and constitutes a distinct economic function, first because they lie outside the routine task which everyone understands, and secondly because the environment resists in many ways that will vary according to social conditions, this is the part I love, from simple refusal either to finance or buy a new thing to physical attack on the man, or we could say woman, who tries to produce it. So, you know, for those folks, and we had a great conversation with Fadi Khandour about this, his discussion of building Aramex and walking, you know, really through the wilderness for a dozen years before really getting traction with what has been one of the most successful new ventures in the Middle East and in North Africa, you know, really underscored more the kind of being ignored than the physical attack. But when we look ahead to changing a large institution or to building something new in a society that's not receptive to something new, to trying to persuade a skeptical audience of the possibility of what doesn't exist, you know, how should the folks on this call, you know, drawing from all we've been discussing this so far, kind of get the momentum and the spirit to push past this type of reaction against change that seems so inevitable?
Well, I wish I knew the answer to that, because in a way I've found myself at the crux of that question for most of my professional life. Even though I have not been an entrepreneur in the sense of creating a new institution, I have tended to be mostly a change agent as a leader of existing institutions. So I've been struggling with that, and which I also consider entrepreneurship. By the way, I consider entrepreneurship can manifest itself in multiple ways, whether it's creating new legal entities or whether it's trying new approaches, a new combination of resources in existing institutions. To me, it has lots of things in common. But it does. Entrepreneurship carries a lot of personal cost, innovation carries a lot of personal cost. It is not just the risk, which is the most visible, the financial risk, which is normally what we discuss more often. The risk that one takes launching a new product, creating a new company, and all that. It is the personal risk of exactly what Schumpeter describes in that quote, of the reaction of the status quo, sometimes pretty aggressive and hostile reaction against the new. And it is part of humankind. I mean, we are machines of control. As human beings, we like to live in predictable environments, and all of us, we get used to a certain way of doing things, and change is always hard, is always stressful, it always uses energy, it is not pleasant. So that is probably the biggest personal cause that any entrepreneur deals with, is the reaction, is the emotional reaction of those who will feel threatened by the change you're promoting, and that those reactions sometimes they can come up with, if you're driving change in an existing organization, can come up from colleagues and employees. Sometimes if you're launching something new in a very well established industry, will come from incumbents. Listen, in higher education, we've had this conversation at times. There have been a few players who've tried different models, some of them for profit, some of them, for example, at University of Phoenix, have achieved a size that no traditional university has achieved. Well, if you pronounce the words University of Phoenix in most traditional universities, you can get into big trouble, because it's become a four-letter right. word, if you will. Right? So, right. So I don't have the answer to that, other than recognizing that dealing with that is probably the biggest personal cost an entrepreneur will have to suffer and deal with.
But it doesn't sound, from what you just said, that when any of the folks on this call, and I have a feeling quite a few of the folks who are participated in this activity, are facing, have faced or will be facing this type of a reaction. It doesn't sound as though your recommendation to all of us is that we should quit as soon as we encounter that type of resistance.
No, not at all. Not at all. Well, Phil, you and I were in New York lucky to be at the Clinton Global Initiative, and you might recall the debate between Muhammad Yunus and the sort of the for-profit microfinance side, which was the first time that Yunus agreed to have that public debate. And I've gotten to know Carlos Daniel, probably the pioneer of for-profit microfinance in Compartamos in Mexico, throughout the years. It is amazing what Daniel and the other sort of pioneers of for-profit microfinance have dealt with on a personal level. I mean, not just the risk of creating entities, the risk of the financial risk of whether they'll succeed or not. Just the ire, just the anger, just the sort of the emotional, the ostracism, the attacks from the establishment. And now we're talking about, if you will, social entrepreneurs being the incumbents and attacking the new wave of social entrepreneurs,
yeah,
which
right.
is very, isn't that interesting?
Interesting.
That
yeah.
Muhammad Yunus himself was a revolutionary, was
right.
again the subject of attacks. He in fact eventually got kicked out, got into big trouble with the authorities in Bangladesh. He's still kind of but on this new debate, when his model is itself revolutionized, then he is on the other side.
Yeah, yeah. Well, no, that's fascinating. Now, Eddie from our course has a great question for you that I think ties a lot of this together, and it's, how can universities be more involved in global communities/issues and create or help create social impact? Are universities doing this enough? Is there a way that universities can be a more positive force?
There's a lot more that needs to be done, and I guess we still haven't found the right models, but everybody's trying. I mean, George Mason itself, a few years ago, started an operation in the Middle East that unfortunately didn't work well, and many But I think it was a great thing that they tried. But there are lots of universities trying different models, trying to figure out how to best serve students who are trying to develop to become global and to be able to have an impact globally. It is not easy. For example, I mean, in the case of George Mason University, we are a public university. We are legally, we are a state agency of the Commonwealth of Virginia, and so we have to always be making a clear case for how our global engagement is good, not just for the whatever countries or communities we decide to serve, but why is it good and valuable for Virginia and for the U.S. I think the answers are becoming more and more clear, and I think everybody now understands that if we want a new generation of Virginians, or like if you want new generations of Madridians or Parisians or whatever it is to be economically successful and drivers of prosperity, they're going to have to know how to deal with a totally interconnected, very diverse, multicultural world. So the challenge is clear. I think it's more and more acknowledged by everyone. The question is going to be, what are the models that are most viable and financially sustainable too?
You know, we have another, I think, interesting question that takes the challenges in higher education from a different angle. You know, I have thought some. I know that you have thought and worked a huge amount on the way in which new models of educational delivery technology, you know, might disrupt the position of universities. But this question asks, how will open source crowdsourcing of knowledge affect universities' research activities? This potential disruption of funding, access to intellectual capital, is there a challenge to universities from that dimension as well on the research side, from crowdsourcing prizes, open access?
I don't think the challenge is on that side. I see the challenge clearly on the teaching side, because we used to have more of a, if you will, a monopoly on knowledge and expertise. Hey, if you're from this region and you want to be educated, we're the ones who have the answer to your problems. You need to come to us, unless you're wealthy enough, you can travel elsewhere. Now the opportunity is about, on the side of research, I actually think university academic research has always been a crowdsourcing exercise. Mm. Now when we look at it, and it has always been an open source play. We look at it now and it looks super old-fashioned when, you know, it takes you probably a cycle of 2 or 3 years to get a paper approved and published in a journal, when, you know, we can push a button and post something on Twitter instantaneously and engage in different kinds of interactions. So it is clear that you know, journals themselves are subject to pressure, that new modes of sharing and communicating research are emerging and will continue to do so. So there are forms in which we operate that will be threatened and changed and altered. But philosophically, I don't know what your feelings are, but philosophically, I think academia has always been an open source play.
Hmm. Yeah, no, I think that's interesting. So we've got these various technological changes that are creating disruptions, certainly creating opportunities, but also anxiety, the stress of change, potential pushback from incumbents. And then we have all this happening in a global context where universities really have no choice but to acknowledge what you've described as the sort of reality of globalization. When you take this entire story to an audience, in fact, at the very beginning you talked about the whole narrative of think global, act local, and describe the need for global partnerships. How specifically would you or will you respond to the folks who say we need to focus first on America? We can't be helping the rest of the world. We can't be focused on international programs. We have to focus on our own people and the talents in our own communities.
Well, the answer is you cannot take America forward if you don't understand the global economy. Take any old-fashioned traditional industry. Take the automobile industry. There's only one way for GM and Ford to make it, to survive it, is for them to succeed. In fact, that's even at the worst of the crisis, the only place GM were making money was in China, right? So there's only one way for the big automobile manufacturers to survive, is for them to understand and to succeed in a global marketplace, is for them to really be able to compete against the Toyotas of the world effectively. You cannot succeed in China. You cannot succeed in Europe if you're just bringing American product and thinking that, hey, it works back in Texas, it should work in Paris. Good luck to you. Unless GM develops in its ranks individuals with that ability to understand differences, to build bridges, to understand other markets, to partner with manufacturers, to partner with distributors, to source technologies, whatever they're produced, to find what the latest innovations are in engines, in brakes, in transmissions, in electronics, in whatever, they're not going to make it. So the fact of the matter is, once again, you know, this idea, I think that this thought experiment of, you know, could you know, I guess the U.S. Somehow build a wall around its border so tall that would sort of isolate us from anything happening outside is ludicrous. That's another world we live in. In fact, the United States has been the driver of globalization. The United States has been the main beneficiary of globalization. And now we have two choices, which is either we learn how to play the game better, or we're, as they would say, our students would say, we're toast.
Yeah. Well, I'm getting a little pushback on Twitter for my question, in that maybe this was a straw man, but I will just articulate that without getting into all the specifics. I have seen this argument alive and well, turning significant institutions in this country in the wrong direction at a critical time because of a failure to grasp exactly what you were just saying on health. I wish that this was a story that we had buried in the 1990s. Somehow or other, it persists with all manner of evidence to the contrary surrounding us. You know, finally, I actually want to close by giving you a chance to offer, you know, some practical guidance to the folks on this call. I think you've given everybody here, myself included, and I certainly had the sense when I read this book of, you know, there are things that each of us does as a consequence of just pursuing our own interests. And then in reading this book, you sort of see how it may add up to kind of a package that actually has value in the world. So I think it's a wonderful book to read from that standpoint. And so I do want to give you a chance to offer, you know, whatever final practical thoughts you have. But before that, I wanted to ask a kind of a philosophical question. You know, the title of this session is Order and Adaptability in Human Societies. And one of, I think, the motivations for my own work is that the real tension that exists in societies is the one that we've been talking about, you know, throughout, the challenge, the tension that exists between incumbent political and economic actors who are the ones who provide the goods and services and organize the society as it exists, so people who are doing tremendously important work, but at the same time, you know, their inclination to resist the challenge of the new and at the same time the imperative of the new. In terms of, you know, taking over a large institution that has processes and functions and course listings, and we have buildings and we have routines and schedules and a certain amount of habit and efficiency that allows all of this to work, And then at the same time, trying to bring about change. How does one balance? I'm really focusing on a large institution for a second, although we're mostly talking about entrepreneurship in this course. But in a large institution, all of the efficiencies that come from order with this kind of necessity of adaptation. How, practically speaking, how do you change a big institution without disrupting that which it does the best, you know, work efficiently at scale?
Well, that is going to be the million-dollar question and the one question that will keep me awake at night for the years to come, unless we have a University of Virginia situation in my second year in the job, hopefully not. I know entrepreneurs are skeptical about big organizations, but big organizations are really the most effective organizations we have. And if you look at the economies that are most competitive, normally they have more big organizations, not fewer big organizations. So the more advanced economies evolve towards having large companies, because those are the ones where you can have more, if you will, specialization, division of labor, and all the benefits that come with it. At the same time, you're absolutely right. Those big organizations then become obstacles for change and become locked in into old technologies. I mean, some of the issues we're having now, trying to transition to new forms of energy and the like. I mean, some of it is technological, but a lot of it is just what Greg Unruh, who did his thesis on this, calls lock in, right? We get locked into modes of thinking and doing. So to me, that is the most exciting sort of leadership issue that we have in our hands is can we have our cake and eat it too? Can we somehow push models of innovation in organizations that have the size and the scale to be most efficient? And we have examples of companies that have done it. We have plenty of examples of companies that couldn't do it and that were left by the wayside. But, you know, take the case of IBM. I mean, going through a few sort of near-death experiences, but they were able to find themselves, to reinvent themselves, and to continue to compete in sort of in totally different environments. Apple itself, that now is hailed as, you know, the most amazing. We still, I guess, have this aura of an entrepreneurial venture, but Apple is a huge corporation. In fact, in terms of market capitalization, probably the biggest in history. And also, it went through a near-death experience about a decade ago, or a little bit longer than that. So it can happen. It is hard, but it can happen. And the question, though, in our industry, I guess we still haven't found many cases of organizations that have really gone through dramatic change and the like. So we'll see. We'll see what lies ahead of us. But that in a way is the big question that we have at Mason and other universities.
Well, yeah, it almost makes entrepreneurship seem easy, but as you've been describing, we know that it's not. So it's all different versions of, I think, a similar process. So to tie it back to our folks on the call, who some of whom we don't know all of our students in great depth, so we may have students and participants in this experience who are trying to lead similar processes of change in large institutions. But for the builders, particularly the young folks who are on this call, what kind of a guidance, encouragement, tips can you give them as they try to develop their skills as global leaders and to create change in the world that they can believe in?
Well, like any skill, whether it's riding a motorcycle or playing basketball or you name it, you have to invest in it. You have to train for it. You have to work at it. And by the way, if you stop, you lose it. I mean, just like being in good shape to run a marathon, For example, I mean, you have choices of what conferences you sign up for, and sometimes it's easier to go to the same conferences again and again in whatever your field is, because you feel comfortable, because you know the people, you're going to run into old friends, you're going to have a good chat and go to a fun dinner. It is a lot harder to take yourself out and seek opportunities when you're going to be exposed to people who are different from you. It is hard. It is easy to get on a business trip. Those of you who have jobs that require that you travel internationally and you land in one modern airport and go to a modern hotel and go back to the airport, come back home, you've totally missed the opportunity. Just stay a day longer, stay a couple days longer, just get out of the hotel, just stay in a hotel that is not a mainstream hotel, just go out, visit a museum, go watch a movie, go have dinner with a local when you know someone extends you an invitation, just jump on the opportunity. So whatever you can do to expose yourself to environments that are different from yours, to people who are different from you, give you an opportunity to get to know people in depth, to develop relationships, those are the kinds of things that will help you, will give you the skills to become more global. And our natural, you just have to acknowledge, it's just like it's a lot easier, and your natural tendency would be to stay sitting on your couch watching TV as opposed to going outside and working out and going for a 10-mile run. It is a lot easier to not do that, to not put yourself in situations that will help you grow to become more global, but that are hard. So that's, I guess, my closing recommendation, which is you have, if you want to be one of those global leaders, if you want to become more global and to have that ability to create solutions by bringing people together, you have to work at it. You have to develop those skills every day.
Well, thank you so much for being on Hill. You know, it's been a great conversation. And I know some of you were on the lines holding. We took the questions by Twitter just to make sure that we stayed technically smooth tonight. Really appreciate your time, and I think we've all gotten a lot to think about from this conversation. And best of luck to you with the remaining 364 days of this year and many years to come being president of George Mason University.
Thank you so much, Phil, and thank you, everybody else. It's been a great pleasure.
All right. Thank you. Bye.